Hello, Illinois Radio Reader listeners. This is Elizabeth McMahon with the Decatur Herald and Review for Monday, May 5th, 2025. I'm going to start here on the front page, and we have a few local stories and some obituaries, but mostly state and national news. I'll do those obituaries in the second half of the reading. Starting on the front page today, there's a large front page feature on the 2026 Senate race with the headline, Stratton Seeks Winning Coalition, Lieutenant Governor, Early Frontrunner for Durbin's Seat. And this is by Brendan Moore of the Lee newspaper chain here. So I'll get started. It's common parlance to talk about an election as if it's a race. For Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, a five-time marathoner who ran in a 5K race just last weekend, this would typically be an appropriate metaphor. But these are atypical times. Stratton, 59, last week became the first major candidate to jump into what's expected to be a crowded race to succeed retiring Senator Dick Durbin. The Chicago Democrats' nascent campaign kicks off amid the backdrop of President Donald Trump's return to power in the nation's capital. It has been a turbulent few months. On-again, off-again tariffs have sown economic uncertainty. The threat of deep cuts looms over social programs such as Medicaid and Social Security, and a crackdown on illegal immigration has led some judges to rule that the administration disregarded due process rights. More than running a race, Stratton said she's gearing up for a fight. If there's anything that I hear from Illinoisans, it's, will you fight for us? And Governor Pritzker continues to stand up and fight. I've been standing up and fighting for people of Illinois, Stratton told Lee Enterprises in an interview on Wednesday. It's what we've been doing this entire 6.5 years of our administration, and I believe that we need that kind of fight in Washington, D.C. Stratton, Illinois' lieutenant governor since 2019 and a former state lawmaker, has quickly established herself as a front runner to succeed Durbin. 2 days into the campaign, she received the endorsement of her boss, Governor J.B. Pritzker, who touted her fighting spirit and dedication to improving lives. Days later, she nabbed the backing of Senator Tammy Duckworth, who praised her tenacity, grit, and perspective. We're building momentum, Stratton said. People are expressing their support, and I really do believe that I'm building a winning coalition. So it's been exciting, she said. It's not going to be an easy road. It's going to be a lot of work, but I got ready day one and rolled up my sleeves, and I'm doing that work. Stratton will almost certainly face competitive opposition in the Democratic Party. Democratic U.S. Representatives Raja Krishnamurthy of Schaumburg, Lauren Underwood of Naperville, and Robin Kelly of Madison are all expected to announce campaigns of their own within the coming days and weeks. Treasurer Mike Frerichs has also expressed interest. On the Republican side, Representative Darren LaHood, a Republican from Peoria, is said to be giving the race a look. With Durbin's departure, Illinois will lose someone with more than 4 decades of congressional experience and 2 decades as the number 2 Senate Democrat. That 1-2 punch of seniority and leadership created a level of clout that brought back a disproportionate amount of federal resources to Illinois for various projects and programs. No one will be able to fill those shoes, at least the right way, but with at least 3 Democratic members of Congress exploring the race, there will be candidates who know the ways of Washington. Stratton, on the other hand, has no experience in federal office, but she doesn't view this as a handicap. In fact, the game has changed, she said. When I travel the state, I hear from people directly. I've been doing listening sessions. I've been going to different parts of our state. I've been to the Quad Cities. I've been to Rockford. I've been to the Metro East and other places. And I believe that we're in a moment that if we don't stand up and fight against what's happening, there won't be any resources to bring back. I mean, look at this plan to cut $1 trillion to give Donald Trump's billionaire buddies a tax break, she said, referring to the House GOP plan to extend Trump's 2017 tax cuts and potential cuts to safety net programs to pay for them. So I think that, yes, We have to get to a point where we can talk about all of the policy issues and what we need to do to bring more resources. But if we don't get in and stop this damage that's coming out of every single day, then what? We've seen the same old playbook in Washington, and it's not working, she said. It's not working. And this is a time when we need fresh voices, new perspectives, new leadership, and that's exactly what I'll bring to Washington, D.C. Stratton is in alignment with Pritzker in both style and substance. She has long called their shared governing record in the land of Lincoln, from raising minimum wage to $15 per hour, to enacting among the most liberal reproductive health laws in the country, a blueprint for what's possible as a country. And with some Democrats striking a conciliatory tone towards dealing with Trump, Stratton is on team fight right along Pritzker, who, at a New Hampshire Democratic Party fundraiser on Sunday, criticized do-nothing Democrats who have been timid, not bold. We have to stand up against what's happening, Stratton said. We have to speak out, and we have to sort of draw the line in the sand and say, I'm not going to allow you to continue to cause so much damage on the working families of Illinois. And there's a level that we have to kind of look at in that mindset that this is a fight. On policy priorities in the Senate, Stratton kept it vague. She said she wants to promote economic opportunity and access to opportunity. As lieutenant governor, Stratton has traveled the state extensively. She has an LG on the Move initiative in which she documents her travels, which often include visits to small businesses and state parks across Illinois. She also chairs the governor's Rural Affairs Council and has an Ag Connects Us All initiative that seeks to bring people together around the state's largest industry. So while the traditional upstate-downstate balance in Senate representation might end when Durbin leaves, Stratton stressed that she plans to run in all corners of and represent the entire state if she wins. I've always taken my role seriously about representing the entire state, and that's why I went to those various communities, Stratton said. People told me, you're not going to come back here, and I did. And I went not just to go and say, oh, look, I'm here, but to listen, learn, and figure out how in state government we can help their communities. People just want to know that there's someone fighting for them. Stratton is married with 4 daughters, and she lives in Chicago's Bronzeville neighborhood. Moving on the front page, we have a local crime follow-up here. With the headline, Sheriff's Office to Review Macon Shooting, and this is by Tony Reed. Macon County Sheriff Jim Root said his office has launched its own internal review into the dramatic events Saturday afternoon that led to police confronting and shooting an armed man at the PNV Quick Stop along U.S. 51 in Macon. The incident began shortly before noon when sheriff's deputies and Decatur Park police responded to the gas station where a caller had reported that a man had crashed a vehicle into another and was standing in the parking lot with a machete acting suspiciously, authorities previously said. Officers began negotiating with the man, but he ran away onto U.S. 51, which was subsequently closed to traffic. The sheriff's office said in a news release that the man then took a sheriff's office squad car and rammed it into a park police vehicle, disabling both. The man then pointed a shotgun at officers, who responded by firing their service weapons at him, the sheriff's office said. The man was taken to Decatur Memorial Hospital for treatment of non-life-threatening gunshot wounds, the sheriff's office said. He was later taken to a hospital in Springfield for injuries sustained in the traffic crash. A Decatur Park police officer was also treated at Decatur Memorial Hospital for injuries from the crash. The Illinois State Police will investigate the incident following protocol for officer-involved shootings. Speaking to the Herald Review on Sunday, Root said, the state police are doing their independent evaluation, and the sheriff's office will conduct our own internal investigation based on the events that took place on Saturday. The injured suspect was not housed in the Macon County Jail on Sunday, and Root said he understood the man was still hospitalized. The sheriff said a decision on whether to arrest him on charges will be made by his office, and any update on that situation will come from his office. This isn't the first time the gas station in Macon has been the scene of dramatic events. On January 13, 2021, a clerk working at the station attacked a 41-year-old female customer who had stopped in at lunchtime to buy a drink. Aaron L. Hand, then 33, had menaced the woman with a knife, and police reports described him gagging her and tying her up after leaving her in the women's restroom. Hand, already a convicted sex predator, stole money out of the store safe. While he was doing that, the victim was able to free herself and run outside to her car. Hand had pursued her, and police said he had jabbed at her with the knife, but she fought him off and made her escape in the vehicle. Hand then fled, but was captured several days later by Indiana State Troopers, who found him at a highway rest stop in Plainfield, Indiana. The defendant pleaded guilty to a charge of aggravated kidnapping and was sentenced to 14 years in prison in January 2022. Our final story here on the front page of the Decatur Herald and Review is an environment-focused story with the headline, Decision Looming for Trump Administration on First PFAS Drinking Water Limits. And this is by Michael Phyllis of the Associated Press. In pain so bad he couldn't stand, Chris Meek was rushed to the hospital with life-threatening ruptured gallbladder. When he emerged from surgery, he learned he had kidney cancer that thankfully hadn't yet spread. Meek, a social studies teacher in Wilmington, North Carolina, was 47 at the time. He remained confused for years about why, as someone seemingly not at risk, he got cancer until Emily Donovan, a parent of students at his school, gave a guest talk about high levels of harmful forever chemicals known as PFAS in the environment. When she mentioned kidney cancer, the possible cause of Meek's diagnosis finally clicked. Last year, the Environmental Protection Agency set the first federal drinking water limits for PFAS, or perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances, finding that they increased the risk of cardiovascular disease, certain cancers, and babies being born with low birth weight. The Trump administration is expected to soon say whether it intends to stand by those strict standards and defend the limits against a water utility industry challenge in federal court. In North Carolina, runoff from a Shemours plant contaminated the Cape Fear River, creating a crisis for cities like Wilmington that use it for drinking water. Amid public outcry, Wilmington effectively eliminated it from tap water. Other U.S. communities, often near military bases or industrial sites, did the same when test results were frightening and public pressure, local leadership, or state law forced PFAS-laden wells offline or prompted installation of expensive filtering systems, according to Mark White, drinking water global practice leader at the engineering firm CDM Smith. So far, sampling found nearly 12% of U.S. water utilities are above the recently set EPA limits, but most aren't above by much. Forcing this group to reduce PFAS more than doubles the rule's health benefits, but roughly triples its costs, the EPA said. The Biden administration's rule set standards for two common types of PFAS and four parts per trillion, effectively the lowest level at which they can reliably detected. Standards for several other PFAS chemicals were set too, and utilities must meet those levels by 2029. Manufactured by companies like Shemours and 3M, PFAS were used in many applications, among them helping clothes to withstand rain and ensuring that firefighting foam snuffed out flames. But the chemicals accumulate in the body, and evidence of harm at far lower levels became clearer. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin champions fossil fuels and the rollback of major clean air and water rules, but as a New York congressman, he supported legislation to regulate forever chemicals in drinking water. Zeldin offers clues about what the EPA could do. The agency estimated the rule would cost about $1.5 billion annually, and he recently said communities struggling to afford a fix for PFAS that are just above the standard might be handled differently than wealthy places with lots of it. What we're going to have to be is extremely thoughtful in figuring this out, he said. On Monday, the EPA said it will establish an agency lead for PFAS, develop wastewater limits for PFAS manufacturers, and investigate sources that pose an immediate danger to drinking water, among other actions. Soon, the EPA must tell a federal appeals court in Washington whether the rule should stand or be rewritten, though weakening it could be complicated because the Safe Drinking Water Act prevents new rules from being looser than previous ones. The agency could encourage exemptions and deadline extensions, according to Eric Olson, an attorney with the nonprofit Natural Resources Defense Council, supporting the current standards in the court case. Consider Avondale, Arizona, which produces PFAS results modestly above the limits. Lowering PFAS may cost Avondale more than $120 million, according to Kirk Beatty, the city's public utility director. That's money a city like Avondale just doesn't have sitting in a back room somewhere, he said, adding he'll defer to federal experts to dictate what's acceptable. If the government decides higher amounts of PFAS are acceptable, that could confuse people. If we enter into a gray area over what's healthy and what's not healthy, then utilities are at risk of being caught up in a debate for which they have no real responsibility nor expertise to decide on, said Corinne Rouget, CEO for Municipal Water at Veolia North America, a water operations company. The American Water Works Association, an industry group, filed a court challenge to the new rule. It agrees certain PFAS should be regulated, but argues the EPA's standards go too far, underestimate costs, and are neither feasible nor cost-effective. There are serious consequences for residents' water bills, it says. The burden of complying will fall heavily on small utilities. Many already struggle to maintain their infrastructure, some experts say, and they face new requirements to replace lead pipes. The AWWA wants the EPA to extend the PFAS and lead deadlines and lead deadlines by 2 years. There is money available to help. The bipartisan infrastructure law provided $9 billion for chemicals like PFAS, and utilities won multi-billion-dollar settlements against PFAS polluters that help as well. Meek, who recovered after surgery and is now 59, plans to sue over his illness. Now he reaches for bottled water. I'm going to move on to more state news. We have a Stateline.org story by Nada Hassanein with the headline, Medicaid Cuts May Disproportionately Affect Black and Latino Doctors and Their Patients. Los Angeles pediatrician and urgent care specialist Dr. Elon Shapiro worries for his chronically ill patients as he watches Congress weigh significant cuts to Medicaid. He thinks of a boy who, before finding Shapiro's clinic, was in and out of emergency rooms and intensive care units because of severe asthma attacks instead of competing in soccer games and studying for exams. The boy's parents were losing hours of pay at work with frequent ER visits. Shapiro, who is Latino, works at a federally qualified health care center, a clinic for low-income patients. Most of his patients are people of color on Medicaid, and roughly a quarter of them are children. Research shows Latino and Black family physicians are more likely to see Medicaid patients compared with their white and Asian counterparts. Experts say the Medicaid cuts Congress is weighing would strap health care centers that rely on already low Medicaid reimbursements, disproportionately affecting communities of color and the physicians they rely on. Of the 72 million people covered by Medicaid, the state federal health insurance program for people with low incomes or disabilities, more than half are people of color, with Black and Hispanic people disproportionately represented on the rolls. Black and Hispanic patients have a higher risk of conditions such as high blood pressure, kidney disease, and certain cancers, making health care access crucial. Congressional Republicans are considering $880 billion in cuts to federal Medicaid spending to offset trillions in tax cuts proposed by President Donald Trump. Conservatives have long argued that Medicaid is too expensive. They assert its expansion under the Affordable Care Act to more working adults has diverted too much money toward non-disabled people, taking resources away from vulnerable populations the program was originally intended to help. But clinicians and policy analysts say the federal Medicaid cuts could have an especially detrimental impact on vulnerable enrollees, including children, older adults, and people with disabilities or chronic illnesses, as states are forced to find savings to fill the gap. One GOP proposal targeting Medicaid expansion could lead to reductions in children's health insurance programs, according to a February report by the Urban Institute. The think tank estimates that proposed cuts to federal Medicaid expansion spending could increase the number of uninsured kids by 11.8%. "I'm deeply afraid," said Shapiro. "It's not just health insurance, it's a lifeline for the entire family that could be severely impacted." Just 6% of U.S. physicians are Latino and 5% are Black, according to the Association of American Medical Colleges. Sustaining the relatively few medical practices with Black and Hispanic providers is important amid evidence that racial bias, lack of access to culturally competent care, and language barriers lead to poorer health outcomes or access. For example, analyses have shown Black patients are less likely to be prescribed pain medication, and some clinicians hold false ideas that Black patients have a higher pain tolerance. Nearly one in three Black, Hispanic, and multiracial women reported mistreatment in medical settings during pregnancy and delivery, such as receiving no help when asking for it or being shouted at, according to a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention study. Language barriers, which Latino communities are more likely to face, are also associated with poorer health or limited access to health care. "We understand the language and cultural concordance and the improved outcomes," said Dr. Linda Mirdamadi, an adjunct clinical assistant professor at the University of Southern California's Keck School of Medicine, who serves on the National Hispanic Medical Association's Board of Directors. "There's a sense of trust." Mirdamadi said federal cuts to Medicaid would lead to loss of preventative care for her large, diverse community. "If they don't have access to health care, they're not going to have the access to chronic disease prevention, to vaccines, to cancer prevention screening," she said. "It's going to just increase the disparity gaps that already exist." Dr. Roger Mitchell, president-elect of the National Medical Association, which represents Black physicians, said a widespread loss of Medicaid coverage would affect everybody, even people with private insurance. "People without health insurance often don't have primary doctors and forego preventative care, resulting in more trips to the emergency room. That can lead to longer wait times at ERs for everyone, regardless of their health insurance." Mitchell also pointed out that Medicaid reimbursements are a major funding stream for hospitals and clinics that see a lot of enrollees. Without that money, many of those providers might be forced to scale back their services or close. "The ripple effect is enormous," said Mitchell, who heads Howard University Hospital in Washington, D.C., where about 40% of patients are covered by Medicaid. "This is an issue that's not just affecting one portion of the U.S. populace, but all of us, and has the potential to have a huge harm." I'm going to do a few more local crime stories here. We have one by Tony Reed with the headline, "Decatur Man Robbed as He Sat in His Car." And I'll begin here. Police said a Decatur man sitting in his parked car near the intersection of North Church Street and West Prairie Avenue suddenly found himself confronted by an armed robber. Sergeant Justin Closen with the Decatur Police Department said the suspect approached the man around noon Thursday and pulled a handgun, which he pointed at the victim's head. The suspect says something like, "Give me your money and you're not going to get hurt," said Closen. The victim handed over a wallet with an undisclosed amount of cash in it, and the suspect left on foot. The victim was not injured. The robber was described as a black man, about 30 years old, wearing a black hooded sweatshirt with the hood pulled over his head and black sweatpants. The victim thought the man possibly had a dreadlocks hairstyle. Anyone with information can reach police at 217-424-2734 or call Crime Stoppers at 217-423-8477. Crime Stoppers pays cash rewards for information leading to an arrest and conviction. Moving on here, we have another crime story. Decatur man alleges he was ordered out of moving truck, and this is by Tony Reed. A Decatur man was hit in the face with a gun after he refused to jump out of a truck traveling at 35 miles per hour, police report. Sergeant Justin Closen with the Decatur Police Department said the 58-year-old victim told officers he'd been a passenger in the vehicle of a man who gave him a ride from the Oasis Day Center for the homeless on West Cerro Gordo Street. Just before 5 p.m. Friday, as the vehicle turned onto West King Street, the trouble started. The gentleman who was giving the victim a ride told him to jump out of the truck while it was still traveling at approximately 35 miles an hour, Closen said. The victim said the suspect then grabbed a handgun and struck him one time in the face, causing a minor injury. The truck then stopped, at which time the victim took it upon himself to exit the situation. The truck was last seen eastbound on Green Street. Closen described the injury to the victim's face as minor and said the investigating officers were left with the impression there may be more to this incident. He said the suspect is described as black, alleged between 42 and 43, about 5'8" tall, and of skinny build with short hair. And after those two briefs, we have a State House-focused story here, a column by Rich Miller with the headline, "Campaigning or Rally Call? Pritzker Draws National Focus." And again, this is a column by Rich Miller. During a rip-roaring speech in New Hampshire last week, Governor J.B. Pritzker called for mass national protests and disruption, assailed do-nothing Democrats for their simpering timidity, and labeled President Donald Trump a madman who cannot be reasoned with. The Jewish-Ukrainian-American governor said of Trump, "Stop tearing down the Constitution in the name of my ancestors. Do not claim that your authoritarian power grabs are about anti-Semitism. When you destroy social justice, you are disparaging the very foundation of Judaism. These Republicans cannot know a moment of peace," Pritzker said. President Donald Trump's Deputy Chief of Staff, Stephen Miller, told reporters that the line could clearly be construed as inciting violence. The president's son, Donald Trump Jr., tweeted at the governor, "Are you trying to inspire a third assassination attempt on my dad? Two wasn't enough for you?" Illinois Republican Party Chair Kathy Salvey claimed Pritzker was calling for political violence against Republicans during his speech. Fox News host Sean Hannity jumped into the fray, claiming the governor all but threatened half the country with violence. But here's the rest of Pritzker's paragraph. "They must understand that we will fight their cruelty with every megaphone and microphone that we have. We must castigate them on the soapbox and then punish them at the ballot box." Pritzker called the Republican accusations ridiculous and continued, "I called for people to take out their megaphones and their microphones, to stand up on soapboxes and get to the ballot box in order to defeat the people who are trying to take so many things away from the American people. That has nothing to do with violence." Basically, Pritzker was the Republican outrage of the day. It's all pretty standard stuff. The Pritzker folks appeared to be unfazed and even found it kind of amusing, with one calling yesterday's developments a masterclass in the right-wing echo chamber. As for the rest of us, we should probably just learn to get used to this. We're in for about 3 or 4 more years of this stuff if Pritzker runs for re-election and then campaigns for president. Mention to anyone near Pritzker that it sure looks like he's setting up for a presidential bid, and they will tell you he's simply trying to rally the party. and the nation against Trump. His folks will also correctly remind you that the 2028 election is years away and the 2026 midterms are the next real concern. I'm going to have to end it there. I'm going to have to take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review shortly. Please stay tuned.